Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. Without a doubt, one of the biggest forces in the world right now is social media. From Facebook groups to Twitter bots to Instagram influencers, more and more, every part of our lives is being shaped and surrounded by social media. And so, on this episode of Real College Podcast, we're taking a closer look at social media. Facebook, online literacy, algorithms, and more here on Real College Podcast. I should get this out of the way right up front. I don't use and do not like social media. I really just don't find it appealing. It seems like a waste of time for me. But I know I am definitely an outlier. And so Tosin Fasimo went around to young people on campus to find out how much they use social media every day.
How often do you use social media?
So I think I use social media every day. It's kind of become part of my schedule. So I'd wake up, get ready, and then on the bus, I'd, you know, check my Snapchat, my Instagram, see what people have sent me and all that. Sometimes during school at lunch or like when class is over. So it's really just like part of my day.
I don't actually have any social media accounts, but I will use other people's Twitters for news about an hour a day.
I probably use it a little under an hour a day.
I probably spend probably like an hour or to two. It depends if like I'm busy that day or not, or if I'm just waiting in line a lot, then I'll use it more.
Probably like 2 hours a day.
Well, I don't really have any sort of traditional social media accounts, but I spend way too much time browsing on Reddit.
Every day for hours a day, I use like Instagram. I put this 2 hour, 30 minute thing, like reminder to tell me when I get to 2 hours, 30 minutes, and it just become, instead of like limiting my Instagram usage, it's become a, like part of my daily routine to just see it and like click it. And I know how bad my life is getting by how early in the day I see that message. Cause I knew it was bad because I saw that message before I even got up today. And I check Snapchat every once in a while.
After the 2016 election, it became excruciatingly clear that how we use and experience social media has big real-world consequences. And so now, more than ever, it is important to use social media in a smart and responsible way. Ben Hallam went to find out what, if anything, we can do to help stop the spread of misinformation online.
In recent years, much of the public discourse around social media has focused on the impact that fake news and misinformation has had on American politics. But why do people believe fake news? And why is social media a particularly useful medium for spreading it? What in particular about the use of these electronic mediums has such a strong effect on our ability to critically assess what we are reading? To find out more about how misinformation works and about what can be done to correct it, I spoke to Pani Kendiyu, a professor of educational psychology who studies misinformation and digital literacy at the Reading and Language Lab at the University of Minnesota. I started by asking her how digital literacy differs from traditional paper-based reading.
This idea that our reading experiences in the context of digital settings are different than traditional settings has been around for a while. And the findings have been very consistent and persistent, showing what has been termed in the literature as the shallow hypothesis. The idea is that in the digital environment, we do not engage in the kind of deep thinking, and we do not persist with that thinking when we compare that to a traditional reading experience. What we've been finding from our work is that our pre-existing knowledge and beliefs are very influential in terms of what we get out of reading some new information in a digital environment. And they are influential in a number of ways. The first has to do with us as readers being biased to some extent to focus on information that tends to confirm what we believe to be true and ignore information that challenges or does not confirm what we believe to be true. And it's compounded also by the fact that a lot of our reading in the context of digital environments takes place in social media where our interactions are brief and fast. And that quick processing also kicks in our system one in terms of our processing system, which is very susceptible to our pre-existing beliefs and biases. It allows us to have those general perceptions about, you know, what is it that I'm reading? Is it aligning with what I believe or not? If it does, then you immediately extract information that confirm your beliefs and you move on to the next thing. It takes a lot for our human system to pause and be critical about something. That's costly. It's costing us attention, resources, and a lot of times patience and time we do not have. And again, if you take that into account in the context of social media, where our interactions, again, are brief and fast, it makes the probability of us engaging in that deep critical thinking even less likely.
Have you been looking at any ways you can talk about people who are involved with these debates and bring critical thinking into these debates? Mm-hmm. Like, what are some strategies for that?
So we are working on a number of what we call interventions that would allow us to not completely eliminate the impact of misinformation and fake news and us being susceptible to accepting it at face value, but at least reducing its impact. So we begin with the assumption that we cannot just erase and replace that information. I mean, it's never going to go away. Assuming that that's the case, what can we do to reduce its impact? And one way that we have found, and we have experimented a lot with it in the lab, is by designing text, brief messages or entire paragraphs or even short texts in ways that allow individuals to co-activate in their memories the information that they believe to be true, but also the information that they're currently reading. And for those two pieces of information to make contact and make them aware that there is an inconsistency. That's the first step. And the way we do that is by what we call refutation texts. So refutation texts are not your typical text that you would read in a, you know, in a book. They would usually say, you know, some people believe that, and I'm going to use a misconception here, some people believe that vaccines contain toxin. In a refutation text, you would say that some people believe that vaccines contain toxins. And then you will immediately refute that statement. You would follow by saying, you know, this idea is incorrect or this idea is false. And immediately after, you will provide a causal explanation as to why that's the case. So you state the misconception, you immediately refute, and you provide that causal explanation. We found that that sequence is your winning sequence. That helps reducing the impact of potential misconceptions a lot. And we do see that during reading with some very sensitive measures of reading times, and also after reading when we ask participants to answer questions about topics that we know they had misconceptions about before reading this text.
So it almost sounds like, so you're calling to mind the misconception at the beginning of the text so that it can be addressed, almost like a conversation between the two ideas?
Exactly. And if you see some of the text stimuli that we use, we present it as if it's a conversation between different characters in a storyline. So our texts look like short vignettes where you have a conversation between different characters and they bring in those misconceptions, they refute them, they explain them, and they move on to provide the correct idea.
I guess thinking in the context of social media, it's kind of shifting it from just reading these short statements to actually like thinking about it like a discussion in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we have situated some of those experiments in settings that look like a blog exchange. In other cases, we examine them as if they appeared in Facebook discussions, and in other cases as different tweets. So we are looking how this would function in different social media platforms to understand better how we can better design these materials so we can offer opportunities for change and revision. I think this idea of fake news, misinformation, misconceptions have drawn attention away from the central issue. And the central issue here is that our news ecosystem has changed, primarily because now we are in an environment where information is easily accessible and is crowdsourced. And the gatekeepers of the past are no longer in place because we are working in a different environment. So being aware, just simply being aware that we have to evaluate information using standards of science and reasoning is critically important moving forward.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
We've been talking about social media pretty broadly for most of this episode, but now let's get more specific. Let's talk about Facebook. Facebook is, without a doubt, the biggest social media platform. And over the last few years, it has stumbled into one scandal after another. A few months ago, you might have missed it, a report came out that Facebook was offering users $20 a month to harvest all of their online data. And so we sent two reporters out to see what people around the university thought of this move by Facebook.
So our question for you is, Facebook put out this app where they'll pay you $20 a month, but they get all of your like phone data. Would you participate?
I don't think my data is worth $20. It's probably worth much more than that. So, plus I don't feel comfortable having my info. Like, I'm not sure how they're using it. So I'd probably need a lot more info before I like sign on to that.
I think not. That sounds really weird to me. Just knowing that they have a use for it is kind of creepy to me.
My data is kind of out there anyway, so I might as well get paid for it.
Because I feel like already Alexa and Siri, everyone's listening, so the government has all the information they need, and any more is just they're gonna take over the world.
Yeah, I would not do it. I just don't trust them.
No, I wouldn't do it. I got rid of Facebook. I think it's kind of scary how much they can watch you and different advertisements show up.
Yeah. I would not download the app for $20 a month. I don't even think I would do it at all. I don't even have a price that I would put on it.
And the deal is only available for people who are ages 13 to 35. Do you have any opinions on that age range?
13 is really young to be signing away all of your data. That's really young.
That seems very specific, so I don't know what they're planning with this, but I don't know. I don't trust it.
You probably wouldn't be paying somebody who's 80 years old $20 a month to do that because they probably wouldn't be giving you much useful data. So,
if you could name any price for your data, would you, and what would it be?
My tuition. Like into like the upper thousands, maybe, like a solid income.
Maybe 500 a month.
Like $50. $50 a month would be cool.
If I got free college tuition, I would do it.
I feel like you could ask up to like $100 for all of the data on your phone.
Well, then I'd go as high as I could. Like I'm saying, like $100 a month. Definitely, but I would take the 20 on the low.
Yeah, if I could set my price, maybe like 50, 100.
Yeah. And any particular reason why that amount?
Because I'm broke.
Thanks, awesome.
This has been Natalie and Bella reporting for Real College Podcast.
Beyond just harvesting our data, Facebook also serves as a platform to stay connected with friends and family via updates and statuses. As a result, everyone's Facebook is sort of this hyper-specific world tailored exactly to them. But what if you could step into somebody else's shoes? See what they see. Nathan Fervoy has more.
2016, my freshman year, was a reality check both for me personally and for the country in general. The dramatic shifts in politics following the 2016 election corresponded with dramatic shifts in my own life, moving away from my hometown for school in Minnesota. Cut off from old friends and dropped into this new, unfamiliar place, I socialized instead with the other students living around me in the dorms. This is how I first met Josh and his roommate Jordan, two South Dakotan high school buddies living a few doors down from me.
What's up, Nathan? I'm Josh Novak. I went to school for a year at University of Minnesota before transferring.
Because they too were transplants from out of state, we spent a lot of time together in those first months of university, eating and exploring and getting to know each other bit by bit.
But yeah, I mean, we had some good times though. I mean, it was floor two East Comstock. Yeah. It was a vibe. The banana situation.
While we were tight, our mutual histories were short and our backgrounds different enough that our understandings of one another could only run so deep. Each night, we'd retire to our individual rooms and onto our individual social media timelines. For me, Facebook became a portal back home where all of everyone I'd grown up and went to high school with was assembled in one place. A space before the filtering process of college expenses and full-time work schedules strained us apart from one another, out into more differentiated, segregated groups.
Like, what I remember about my freshman year a lot was, like, really using, like, Facebook way more than I ever had before, and in a way that was, like, I felt like it was, like, compulsive, like, I, like, was like addicted to it to like some extent, and like not extremely, but like to the extent like I would be using it, I'd be like, why am I even on here? When I never like really felt that way before for my freshman year. Like looking back on it, I think it might have had to do with like that space, the space of Facebook being kind of like feeling like I was back home.
I remember using it a lot too, and I think everybody does to some, or do you find some sort of vice when you're like, if you're homesick or if you're lonely and you're just like trying to figure out what else is going on, or bored, you know, it's just like, let's be honest. And I think that's a time when people are, at least I experienced that.
And then of course, like it was also 2016, the election, which was like quite like a time, you know what I mean? Like the
approaching election served as an undercurrent for that year and started to create a bit of tension between my online and IRL lives. On my timeline, I steeped in the liberal voices of my peers from home, and then I would take this amalgamation of ideas from my peers out for test spins and debates with Josh and Jordan, who presented more conservative perspectives, which they surely found back on their timelines. I remember these debates as constructive and friendly for the most part, yet each day the divide seemed to grow more pronounced and urgent online. Across the board, the election seemed to give a new dimension to the structure and limitations of Facebook. In the years that have followed, Facebook has become the subject of investigations for its influence on the election, with Mark Zuckerberg testifying before Congress and reports of Russian trolling. It seems Facebook and the internet in general expand our worldview, but also seem to constrain us within personalized bubbles that seldom present us with outside perspectives in a constructive way.
I think it was a super interesting time because everybody was on the extremes, you know, at least it perceived that way. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's actually the case. I mean, in the way people present themselves, it's very left or right. But when in reality, I think if we really have an honest conversation with each other, like we have a lot more in similar than we have different. Mm-hmm. But in that election specifically, as we all know, it was extreme polarization. Like it was either you were on one side or you're the other. It was like a borderline reading about a war. And you're like, man, it's not accurate for how humans really perceive that. Like, we all have different thoughts and opinions and how that thing works. And it's not like we're all in one boat or all in the other. Mm-hmm. You know, like, obviously...
The voices of Josh and his roommate have stayed with me, even after they returned to South Dakota the following year. the perspective still popping into my head from time to time when weighing out an argument. While it was at times uncomfortable or confusing, I believe that the kind of out-of-the-bubble encounter we shared to be necessary in a world more interconnected than ever before. But this was all over 2 years ago now, and another election is looming on the horizon. From the articles in my feed, it would seem that the country is still polarized as ever, but what about from outside my bubble? I called up Josh for the first time since freshman year with a strange proposal. How about a Facebook swap? A trade of accounts in order to view the world from a new and separate bubble. He was down. We met up in Minneapolis to do the ceremonial swap of passwords.
A Facebook swap. Like, what are your expectations going in? Like, what are you feeling about it?
I think it'll be really interesting because we obviously come from different backgrounds. I come from a much more conservative background, and I think it's fair to say you come from a much more liberal background. So I think it'll be interesting to perceive those two worlds together. Like, I'm no big Trump fan by any means, but, you know, I do have probably more people in my sphere of influence that are, and, you know, that influence you might see peek through on some of the things that that you see on my page.
But yeah, I don't know. Should we do the old swap?
Let's do the swap.
Yeah, let's see. I guess how could we do it? Oh wait, before we do it, are there like any like rules we should decide on like beforehand, like? Especially like messenger wise, like just like avoid the messenger probably.
I'm an open book.
You're an open book?
No. Yeah, let's just avoid each other's messengers.
Like, I don't know what like that goes back years.
Yeah. You know? No, we can just avoid messenger.
Yeah.
That's a good call. Other than that, you know, I'm not gonna be commenting on your stuff.
Yeah, probably no posting, no
yeah,
commenting.
Yeah. I'm gonna be commenting like what's this
I'd say feel free to like look as much and like explore as much as you'd want, you know what I mean? Like click through whoever and on whatever. It'll be a whole nother world. So yeah. Should we do a ceremonial swap?
I got the passwords pulled up for
should
it.
We like
boom.
The swap is complete. Yeah. So
right off the bat I got a good Parks and Rec meme.
And with that, we went our separate ways, agreeing to reconvene in a few weeks.
Oh, here we go. How are you feeling today? Okay. Ambient noise.
Starting off, the experiment legitimized my bad habit, so I was happy to indulge and scroll for hours on end. Whether I fully acknowledged it or not at first, my eyes scanned for some inflammatory political content to latch on to.
If anyone needs boxes, I have a bunch. I would love to have out
not
of
that,
my
not
house.
Not that mine's like uber exciting, but like, there's no funny memes. Like,
where was the Trumper content at? The right-wing statuses that I could chuckle to myself about. After many hours on the lookout, with nothing but a few pro-gun videos, became clear that the primary feature of Josh's Sioux Falls bubble was not politics.
This is just really boring.
Yeah, a little bit.
It was vanilla family stuff.
Wow, but like,
and the memes were terrible. A week in, I wrote in my notebook, people seem put together and kind to one another. They update on the positive things in life, school, family, smiling pictures, mature and professional.
It's just basic shit.
I began to have some concerns that this experiment was about to be way more revealing of my friend group's dark sides than it would be of Josh's. They dwell on the positives, where in contrast, my feed is less washed, more fuck shit. People share their dark inner thoughts more openly. More truthful? Perhaps. But definitely more funny. Searching for a reason for the lack of chaos in Josh's feed, I tracked it back to something he'd said when we'd first met up about curating his feed.
I think one thing that I've done with my socials is I'm very quick to remove negativity from people. Mm-hmm. So like if I have a friend that's going off on, you know, how, you know, Hillary Clinton's the worst person in the world, I'm like, man, I don't got time in my life for that. Like, I don't need that, nor is it productive. Mm-hmm.
I'd never thought to filter my friend list in this way before. If anything, I paid more attention to the loud, crazy people of my feed. Now I'm starting to consider a new perspective on the crazies.
Wow, okay. Marriage exists most ultimately to display the covenant-keeping love between Christ and his church. Wow.
Trying to conceptualize the cleanliness, I drew upon the increased godly presence of organized religion I saw in Josh's feed. Was the idea of projecting one's best self and filtering out negative energies based in religion? Did this strategy really make everyone better off and happy, or did it only ignore taboo problems going on? Were my friends too open to negativity and depression as normal? All of these questions began to build up into a slight existential crisis. I needed to ask Josh what was going on.
Hello. What's
up, man? How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Yeah, you want to go?
Yeah, I'll give my first, reactions to it. And I think what interested me the most is, like, I didn't like using your Facebook. In the sense of, like,
I didn't like using yours either.
You know what I mean? Like I don't say that insultingly at all, but it's like, because it's so curated to you, it's like, it's just different. It's like, well, I'm not, I don't scroll as much where I'm like, you know, I'll pop it open, scroll. I'm like, all right, that's cool. You know? And it's like, because I think how people perceive the world differently in like comedy and like everything, what they think is funny and whatnot. Like, even though like we can hang out and it's like super normal, just like the social media side of things is so curated to like what you find funny or find interesting or like want to learn more about is interesting, you know? Like your stuff was much more like meme heavy and more comedy heavy, and mine was more, I think I have mine more to like random people that I know and like just their day to day.
Right.
You know, and so like, which would make it really boring for you because you're like, who are these assholes? Like, I don't care.
Yeah. For sure. It was like, I was like, where are the memes? I was like, John, where are the memes?
And I'm scrolling and I'm like, where are the people?
was that it was like, there was like more like older people that you know, more. Not like family, but just like people in Sioux Falls, it seemed like.
Yeah, and that's that's not normal. That's just from like having been working with those type of people for like, you know, past 4 years in Sioux Falls. Like, that's not necessarily normal. Mm-hmm. Like, my feed is probably very abnormal to most people my age in Sioux Falls, just because like I've been like working with, you know, companies and whatnot.
It seemed like. Yeah, like a bit more like professional and like
right.
Just like and like cleaned up in some type of way also, which is I don't know if you remember like when we were first met up and we were like exchanging, there was like something you said kind of off the cuff, so I don't know like if I'm reading into it too much, but you mentioned that like part of the way that you use like your Facebook and your social media is that, I don't know what the exact quote was, but it was like, if somebody's posting like negative content or like angry content, you might be inclined to like block them or just like unfollow them that you don't see that.
I'll just like unfollow so I just don't see their tweets, but like I'm, you know, sometimes I'm still friends with them. You know, I just don't need the negativity out here.
And like, well, I was wondering like, is that like a common thing for you to do? Is like, do you do that?
No. I bet you I haven't done that to 10 people.
Okay.
You know, 20 people.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was thinking about that type of like religious sentiment or something like that, or like many times was like connected back to something like that in a way that was not like, there's not that much of a religious presence on my feed, I feel like.
Right.
And I was thinking, in some way, is that like when you say like you're trying to surround yourself in like positive, more like positive feedback or like energy, and is that connected to some type of like religious fundamental for you, you think? Or,
you know what, to be honest, the positivity thing is just a healthy thing for me. It's like, man, I just have a better day when I'm, you know, when I'm with friends that are positive, when I have those things, and then you can have, you know, you move forward on things.
I'm going.
Logging back into mine.
Log out.
Home sweet.
Logging out.
Home sweet home.
Yeah. All right, man. Thank you for agreeing to this experiment.
For Real College Podcast, this has been Nathan Furman.
Finally, unlike Facebook or Twitter, we may not think of music streaming platforms as social media, but these platforms shape the type of music we listen to and find. And so, Lizzie Ritchie decided to look into Spotify and Apple Music, the two biggest streaming platforms, and weigh the pros and cons of each.
A very hot topic lately has been the Apple Music versus Spotify debate, and to which one is the better streaming platform. I've been using Spotify for almost 3 years now, so as you can guess, I'm a diehard Spotify user. But from what I have gathered from talking to other folks around Minneapolis is that a lot of Spotify users are very pro-Spotify. But when it comes to Apple Music, the users are often indifferent and just keep using it because they have been using it for so long and don't really want to make the switch. So, I wanted to set out to find someone who is just a bit more passionate about using Apple Music to talk about our differences to see if we could find a middle ground.
I have Spotify, but I don't super love it, and I don't know if I'm just being biased because like I like the old iPod kind of version of just like having all the music right there. Like an iPod Classic would be like ideal, I feel like, for me. But I'm just like an old man about it, so I like a good shuffle going on a lot. And Spotify, to me, it seems like harder to like build your own like library of music, even though there totally is like a library feature. The playlist I like usually is just like shuffling through, and that's what I like go for when I'm DJing, I feel like, is just a weird like shuffle and like kind of like, instead of like playing to a mood, just like breaking a mood or something like that.
Through my conversation with Nathan, another RCP host, we got deep into talking about the social media aspect of the two apps, along with the algorithm that makes our music streaming experiences so different from one another.
So Spotify, yeah, I could for sure seen it good for that. But and it does like introduce you, and it has like those built-in playlists that are like your weekly release.
I love
release.
Those.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is so weird to me. Or like I like get it, but I also am like kind of wary of that, and I because of just the way that it works, I feel like is kind of like a corporate thing where it's like you definitely the artists that get placed in that are for the most part paying or like have a label that is like positioning them to like get into those playlists, I feel like. And that is like, I mean, that's how just like the music industry works, I guess. But I think there's something that's a little bit like sus about that. And so I'd rather just listen to what like my friends tell me to listen to rather than like what an algorithm tells me I should listen to based on like what I've listened to before.
Spotify as a streaming service is heavily based on algorithms in comparison to Apple Music. But that is a part of the reason why people like it so much. Because the service is so tailored to the individual, and because it has a well-developed algorithm that helps show users new music they may not have discovered otherwise. Nathan, on the other hand, talked about how he likes Apple Music because it is less involved, and why algorithms may be hindering us more than they are helping us.
I think algorithms can kind of like move people into like certain like spaces of music. I don't know. Algorithms I don't fully trust. Before there was no like control on who was putting the music in front of you. It was just like you heard like from a friend or you saw something online that said this was good. Now it's more, again, in like the hands of like the labels that
the
get to
the
establishment, like the corporations, man, and they get to say like they have a lot more influence now on like who you are actually going to listen to, which, you know, not necessarily essentially a horrible thing, but also maybe makes it harder for like new artists to make an impact. Just like it's important to like have some kind of randomness, because like you can get a little trapped if you're just getting like, you know, typed or whatever.
I agree that algorithms can be both helpful and harmful, something that a lot of people can probably agree on. Of course, we are going to like a more random selection of music when streaming. It's a boring feeling to be stuck in what feels like a bubble of things you're exposed to. This goes for music, videos, practically anything that we consume on the internet. And I'll be honest, this is something I would have to admit liking more about Apple Music. They definitely are less involved in our streaming experience. All this talk about algorithms led to a conversation on the future of streaming platforms and the possibility of what is in store for us as listeners.
I just miss when it was more random and it was more, you know, free to explore the frontier, the Wild West of the internet, but it's no more. Yeah, I wonder if the next streaming service will like make it like so that that's actually possible again, which is funny, like you'd be paying to have that, but then, you know, that's it's weird, but that I'm guessing like that's probably going to happen eventually, where like there's going to be some feature where it's like totally random feature, but it's like you got to pay $10 a month for it, so it's like not everybody can do that.
It's definitely possible in the future that paying for anonymity and randomness could be a thing. I hope it doesn't go in that direction, but it does make me wonder, if it came down to it, would that be something I would do? To the listeners, is that something you would pay for? This has been quite an interesting conversation with Nathan, and also an enjoyable one. I encourage all of you to start havoc in your classrooms, your friend groups, even your own home. Ask the people around you, which is better, Apple Music or Spotify? My opinion may be just changed.
That is all from Real College Podcast. Thanks to Tosin Fasimo, Ben Hallam, Natalie Goose, Nathan Fervoy, and Lizzie Ritchie for their work on this episode. Real College Podcast is produced by Lizzie Ritchie, Liv Riggins, Ben Hallam, and Nathan Fervoy. Alex Schumacher is the host and managing editor. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K, and all of our episodes can be found online at radiok.org, as well as on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.